welcome back to Your Favorite Album, the podcast where we sit down with someone and ask, hey, what's your favorite album? I'm your host, Adam Santiago, and joining me this time is Greg Wyszynski from Puck Daddy. Hey, did I say your last name right?
You did indeed. You did better than most telemarketers have done throughout my entire life. Yes, indeed.
There we go. Thanks for being on the show. I've been a fan of your site for many years.
Why, thank you.
I have a Rick Nash jersey that I won from you guys once.
That's right.
At a meetup.
At a big old meetup party at Foley's.
Yeah, it was a good time. Yeah.
It was a great time, man. It was, we do what we can. We proudly represent the American hockey fan on Yahoo Sports and try to battle those silly Canadians who believe that they own the sport and that the sport's a religion and yada, yada, yada. That's our lot in life is to raise Old Glory and storm the border.
I like it. So let's just start this off with the same question we always go through. Greg, what's your favorite album?
My favorite album is Siamese Dream by, at that point, Smashing Pumpkins.
The actual incarnation.
Right, as they got more pretentious and dropped and added people, they became the Smashing Pumpkins. But at that point, just Smashing Pumpkins.
Very true. I can hear my ex-roommate's boyfriend somewhere being very angry, because so many people I could never schedule with me, and they're like, Siamese Dream. I always said, first come, first serve, you know?
Well, there's been a nice renaissance about the album because of the anniversary of its release and, you know, in the last couple of years. And it was cool to see. I don't know if maybe just nostalgia's been kind to it or just because people generally like the band from that era and are just so mad about where it all went.
Yeah.
That they wanted to kind of just celebrate that moment in rock where it was like, you know, this sort of weird, nerdy, funky looking quartet from Chicago is over here doing their thing while all the Seattle bands are doing their thing. And it was an interesting time. And for, you know, 3 or 4 years, like, that band, for whatever reason, became one of the biggest bands on the planet.
Yeah. Would you say they kind of peaked after Melancholy, or was it, what, Ava Adore or something?
No, it was after Melancholy. I mean, Ava Adore was a big song. I mean, not as big as the singles off of Melancholy. But then that's when you started to get into Jimmy Chamberlain's drug problems. Like, I remember on the Adore tour, I saw them at Radio City, and they had, I think, two drummers to try to replace the sound Jimmy made, and, you know, it wouldn't even work. And then all of a sudden Darcy leaves or gets fired or whatever it was. Yeah. And it wasn't the same vibe. And then they tried to, make it work with that Machina album that was trying to recapture the crunchy guitar sound from the previous albums. And time had passed.
Yeah.
Time had passed for the band. And there's that.
That is true. That is true. So, like, what do you say? Like, why is this your big album?
So how I came to the Smashing Pumpkins, and the Smashing Pumpkins remain my favorite band. I mean, it's the band that I revisit a lot.
That's dedication, because I feel like they've burned.
They're my favorite band from the music they've produced. I mean, I actually saw them at the 930 Club in D.C. A couple years ago, and it was Billy and no one you've ever heard of. It was a tour in which he was promoting, I think it was called Oceana was the album, or it was a tour right before it came out. And they went into the catalog and played just a bunch of like album cuts from the Pumpkins albums. And it sounded great. And I know it sounded great because these are great songs.
Yeah.
And so I revisit these songs a lot because there was such a variety of the stuff they made, and they got weirder, and there was angry stuff, and there was melodic stuff, and there was get hard on your sleeve romantic stuff. I mean, to the point where, you know, because Billy has to basically, you know, just highlight and underscore everything five times, the shirts they made had hearts on the sleeve, for Christ's sake. So but I mean, they remain my favorite band because they meant so much to me when I was of that age, you know, high school age, when the album came out. And so I came to the band through, I know some people find music this way, I don't know if they do it anymore because movies don't have soundtracks anymore.
Yeah, but, sadly.
But I found the band through the singles soundtrack, you know, which was the grungiest grunge soundtrack of the time, Pearl Jam, Screaming Trees. And they had Drown on that album, which, you know, I heard. I'm just like, wait a second here. This is awesome. So the song, the lyrical part of the song is like 2.5 minutes, and then it just goes and it becomes this beautiful feedbacky melodic thing for like 7 minutes. I'm like, this is awesome. So then I wound up getting, you know, finding Gish. At that point, it was probably at my local record store because it wasn't really a hugely popular album. And discovered that, and then Siamese Dream came out, I think a year after the single soundtrack came out, and I just devoured it. I mean, it was so cool. I mean, it was because I love the band in its, you know, sort of Gish form, loud guitars and big melodies and almost sort of sparse arrangements. And then you know, Butch Vig decides to kind of up the game sonically. And Corgan decides to up the game sonically with Siamese Dream, and they throw everything, every influence, everything they possibly can into these songs and work on them until, you know, it takes, you know, they're spending a day on a second of a song, and it just, it shows in the work. I mean, it's a really close to perfect album in my mind.
Nice, nice. Yeah, I was trying to think, and I think it was around Siamese Dream when I first heard of them, and I think I kind of did it backwards. Like, I heard Disarm on the radio. Mm-hmm. But I never really looked into it further. And then MTV was playing the Today video all right. The time. And it's like, man, this is...
With the ice cream truck.
Yeah, and it's like, this is great. I like this.
That was the other thing, too. I mean, in listening to the songs again in preparation for this, like, it's... This album hit at a time when video still mattered. And it hit at a time where the band's personality could really come through in the video work that they did. And Today with the ice cream truck and Disarm with the black and white video and the big sweeping cameras over them playing, you know, people playing the cello, and Rocket is basically a song defined by its video, where at the end the whole thing is a gag where a bunch of kids build a spaceship, and at the end they go to meet the pumpkins, and the pumpkins are all elderly because it took them so damn long to fly to the planet. Like it came at a time when videos could define songs, and I think the pumpkins really knew how to use that medium to add a you know, a glossary or add a coda to the work that's on the album.
Good stuff. And was this... So how old were you when this came out? Because I was 10. Right.
So 93, I think it was, is when it came out. So that would be 16 for me. Around 16, okay. 15, 16 for me.
So this hit you like at the right time, too, where you were like, I can relate to all this stuff.
High school, it's right as grunge is going. And you're right. I mean, all the themes of the album, you know, the you know, let me out stuff and the ooh, my parents just are terrible kind of stuff, and then you know, eventually at the end of the album, sort of and in different parts of the album, sort of this hopeless romantic part as well. I mean, it's all there. I mean, it's you know, Billy Corgan painting with the big brush of adolescent angst at that point, and it was a really beautiful ride.
Now, were you alone in your love of this, like, growing up, or were there, you know, because sometimes you get into stuff that's really big, but at the time, you're the only one, like, in school, like, some music just doesn't catch on as quickly.
It seemed like at that point, remembering it in high school, it seemed like at that point, everybody had their freak flag for a different grunge band. I mean, you know, he had the Nirvana kids and the Pearl Jam kids and the Soundgarden kid who was over here, and he was just like giving you the finger because his band was the best musically. And, and then you had the Pumpkins, and I was a Pumpkins kid, and it was sort of a weird place to be because, you know, unlike, you know, Pearl Jam, where you could hear direct sort of lines drawn to Neil Young and things like that, and Soundgarden had a sort of traditional metal feel to it, and Nirvana obviously is, you know, the Pixies reincarnate. You know, the Pumpkins are over in this weird area where the guy with the nasally voice is singing, and you may not like that. It's definitely not Chris Cornell. It's an acquired taste, and they've got, you know, Cheap Trick influences and Bowie influences, and they're making little weird songs, and it was not the rest of grunge, and I think that sort of set it apart and made it, I think, a bit more divisive. I mean, when, you know, when I was 15 or 16, if you weren't a Nirvana fan, you were out of the club. But if you weren't a Pumpkins fan, it was sort of, I think, a bit more accepted that maybe maybe they're not for all tastes.
Gotcha. Huh. And so did you have a certain couple tracks you'd just play constantly, or were you just listening to the whole album?
I listened to the whole album because, you know, to just completely date the thing, it was the album I had was on cassette.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
And
yeah.
So the way it was structured was really interesting because the last song on the first side was the song Soma, which was just a knock you on your ass, beautiful song, and it builds and builds and builds, and then it's just got these big triumphant guitars, and it's so emotionally overwrought. And then the next song after that's Geek USA, where they kind of like kick it back up again, and it's a it's one of the better rockin' songs they made. I loved the flow of the album that way. I mean, you know, some songs go loud, quiet, loud, you know,
yeah,
quiet, loud, quiet, and the album kind of flowed that way too, where you have sections of melodic stuff and more, you know, happier poppy tunes, and you get back into the heavy stuff. As far as tracks go, I mean, you know, I was always a huge fan of the aforementioned Rocket, because it was sort of, you know, a pretty blatant Bowie rip. I mean, it had these sort of, you know, Spiders from Mars guitars and sort of references to that through Billy's vocals. Today is the most beautiful song ever written about suicide. I mean, the thing about the album is that, like, it's dealing in very dark themes. I mean,
there's
suicide, there's child abuse. And at the time, Corgan has said that, you know, he was like, you know, 2 months away from trying to kill himself when he wrote the album. And so there's a lot of that in there. And Today is, I mean, you know, there's certain themes in music that I love. And one of them is this sort of psychotic optimism that you get when in your darkest hour.
Yeah.
Bowie's Heroes, which is my favorite song, is that all over it. And Today is very much that. It's very much this sort of like, you know, can't wait for tomorrow. Tomorrow's too long. And you know, I love that about that song, even though it's just wicked dark. And then, you know, my favorite Pumpkin song is actually, as I look through some notes, is actually on the album, which is Mayonnaise. It's on the second side of the cassette.
It's right after side B,
right after Geek USA, right before Space Boy. It's just a beautiful song, and it's sort of a curveball from them, in the sense that it's sort of a mid-tempo song. It's not, you know, acoustic-y, like acoustic ballady, like Disarm was in some ways, and it wasn't super rockin'. It was just sort of this nice sort of flowing Cheap Trick reference before, that kind of vibe to it, and it's just, it builds into something really beautiful, and you know, the whole album's great.
Yeah.
And you know, Cherub Rock's fun, because Cherub Rock was a direct reference to the Seattle scene, I thought, and like how people were selling out left and right. And it's, I think, one of the last songs Corgan wrote for the album, and probably is sort of self-referential too, in the sense that he knows that this album is going to be huge and poppy and big. And I just, it's such a nasty little song. I mean, the next one that came in that sort of subgenre was probably Serve the Servants by Nirvana in Utero. But this one, I think, is like top of the charts as far as like the nasty little cattiness of these bands, as some get record deals and some don't. And it's a great track.
The thing I love about like albums that people encounter in their high school, because it leaves me with so many questions, like, so okay, you know, were people into it, or like, did you pop this on mixtapes to like like, what songs did you go with on mixtapes, or did you give them to like someone you had a thing for? Though a couple of these songs, you're like, well,
no man,
yeah, it wouldn't really.
If I had a thing for someone, I was probably just taping songs off of Z100 at that point.
Yeah, I feel that was the way to go,
and trying to cut the commercials as best I could, because we didn't have the tech to make it smooth. But no, this was sort of like a personal thing. I mean, like I have vivid memories of listening to stuff. I have vivid memories of Soma being a song that I listened to during breakups, just because it was just so, you know, epic and emotional. I'd, you know, Hummer was sort of a trippy sort of psychedelic song. It's got some sort of Eastern guitar vibe at the beginning of it. And I remember like sitting on a balcony at like the beach on vacation with like my parents in like St. Petersburg, Florida, and it's at night, and it's just like you have the ocean in front of you and stars in the sky, and you're listening to this sort of, you know, sweeping song in your Walkman at that point. I don't know. It's like you said, it's an album that hit the right time, and the great thing about albums that you love when you're a kid, that are good that you don't revisit, and all of a sudden you're like, all right, so maybe New Kids on the Block wasn't the next iteration of the Beach Boys. Is that not only do they hold up, but then you can add layers to it as you get into, you know, you understand music more and you understand music history more. And with Siamese Dream, I mean, obviously, not only is it just understanding the influences that came and seeing the pieces fit and that kind of thing, but also understanding the band more within the context of that time. Because, you know, when you're 15 or 16, I mean, it's before the internet, right?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think I had AOL dial-up at that point, maybe, but nothing beyond that. And, you know, I'm not reading, you know, too much dirt sheet stuff from the band at that point, but, like, you know, when you find out that, like, this album was made basically by three people, by Billy Corgan, by Jimmy Chamberlain, the drummer, and by Butch Vig, the producer, and then the other two members of the band were basically cut out because Billy redid all their parts, you're like, wow, that's crazy. and the craziest thing about it was that despite the fact that Billy Corgan, the band would play the song, and then Billy would go back and re-record the parts of James Iha and Darcy, the bassist. And normally you'd say to yourself, I would quit this fucking band.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm out of here. Like, but they stayed on, and they stayed on, I guess, one, because it's a good gig.
Definitely.
And then two, because there was this acknowledgement amongst all of them that Billy was a better musician than they were. And so they would actually stay around for the mix sessions and offer, you know, constructive criticism of him re-recording their tracks, which is crazy. But, like, when my chosen profession is journalism. As an editor, you know, you have to understand that sort of compulsion sometimes and perfectionism sometimes. And you know, the first time I rewrote somebody's lead and kind of maybe threw a little of my own pepper in there into that recipe, you say to yourself, oh, I get it. Like, you just want it to be good, and you want your vision to come through, and you don't want people to walk away from it being like, well, that sucked, and then you don't want to have to be blaming it on other people when you could have made a difference at that point. And that's the mania that drove this album, is this sort of obsessive perfectionism. You know, he's megalomaniacal too, but that Corgan had to make this album as good as possible.
Yeah. Now, do you think this album would have resonated as well with you as if it had hit you maybe when you were like in your mid-20s, or, you know, if it came out now?
I think it probably would have, only because the song craft's there. Let's say I was in my 20s, because if I was in my 20s, I probably would have really liked Gish as well, and probably would have liked it better than I did when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what I loved about this album is that it took that foundation. It's a classic second album. Like, it took that foundation of really good tunes that were probably about 3 minutes too long, and then condensed it into pop songs. And there's a lot of pop songs in this album.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, Today's a Pop Song, and Cheerbox a Pop Song, and there's a lot of that on this album. And I think it would have resonated to me as someone who appreciates that song craft.
Hmm.
As far as, like, the band goes, I think I probably would have still dug it. I would have dug the weird little, you know, Eastern European girl on bass, and I would have dug the Asian dude on guitar, you know, putting his hair down over his face and doing shoegaze. And
yeah.
And I probably would have dug Corgan at the time too, because he kind of he just looked like a fat kid from your high school who made his own t-shirts before he became, you know, this big bald Mr. Clean looking dude that he became on the next album.
Yeah. I also totally had a crush on Darcy as a kid.
Yeah, it was the, you know,
it's like, oh man, who's this badass on the bass?
The rage of the female bassist. Like, I mean, you know, you eventually realize she's terrible. I mean, she's got sort of Meg White disease in the sense that she's, you know, terrible, but you accept it. And she was, you know, she's part of the band.
But that's what makes it work, I feel, sometimes. Like, with the White Stripes, it's...
Right.
It's Meg White fills a role, and it just makes you appreciate how good the music is, despite the limitations.
Well, there's a symbolism to it.
Yeah.
Not only does it look cool, but, you know, a lot of these songs that Corgan wrote are definitely really sort of sensitive odes to romance and heartbreak and things like that. And when you have a lady in the band, it kind of, you know, if it's Soundgarden writing these songs, it's going to resonate differently than when it's the, you know, some nasally fat kid and a girl on bass.
Yeah, I can, yeah. I just remember going through all this stuff and, like, listening to these songs in high school and just being like, am I just, like, throwing myself further down a well of despair sometimes, yeah. You know? But then after a while, you come out of it like, all right, I feel better. It helped me vent through this crap.
There is a lot of that. There's a lot of sort of catharsis in some of the harder tunes.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, like I said about the flow of the album, like, the hardest track on the album arguably is Silverfuck, which is you know, I think the third to last song, and it's one of these just gigantic honking gaseous Billy Corgan operatic rock things that he would, there's like five of them on the next album, and then there's two of them on this album, Soma, which is I think more successful than the Silverfuck song. But then after that he throws in this song Sweet Sweet, which is like 2.5 minutes long, and it sounds like it should be played on a lute.
Yeah.
And then there's this beautiful song at the end called Luna, which is just like, it's romance. It's just a romantic song. It's a ballad.
Yeah.
And it kind of, the album kind of carries you out on this sort of optimistic note that runs a bit contrary to the angry, crunchy stuff that came before it, I think.
I feel those two last tracks would be just as home at home on Melancholy.
Yeah.
Like right at the end of Melancholy.
He pulls the same trick there too. Yeah. Like, so that's a double album, and the first album is, you know, I think like there was like Dawn and Twilight or however they structured it. And then the first album is where you find Zero and where you find, you know, Tonight and some really big rock tunes. And then the second album begins with that. And then like the last four or five tracks are all very sort of quirky, and there's a song called Starlight, which is just beautiful.
Man, such a good song.
Oh yeah, I mean, and so it's the same trick in that album too, where they're kind of carrying you out on this sort of dreamlike, romancy thing. And they were really good at that too. One of my favorite Pumpkin tracks ever is it's in the box set that they came out with, and I want to say it's on the Bullet with Butterfly Wings single. It's a cover of Blondie's Dreaming.
Ooh, I don't think I've ever heard that.
It's a duet between Corrigan and Darcy. And much like Drown, it's like they get through the lyrics and then the song kind of just carries you through. And it's very, very sort of slow and trippy, but it works for what it is.
I mean, yeah, say what you want about that guy. Man, can he put together a song?
I mean, at the end of the day, I think people just got tired of it and got tired of the ego you know, he becomes the rat in the cage guy, and it's like, you know, but
he's now like, he's in wrestling.
Now he's in wrestling.
He's like, yeah,
he's
do this.
He's super opinionated, and he's on the cover of Cat Fancy, I think, at this point. But, and also just like the idea of all the power struggles and stuff too. And also once you become the guy who's desperately trying to recreate the things you've already done.
Mm-hmm.
And they did that. They had an album. What the hell do they call it? It's the one that had Tarantula and the United States of America.
Yeah.
Had the Statue of Liberty on the cover. See, I don't remember the name of it. But again, like from a nostalgia standpoint, there are moments on the album because it was basically him and Jimmy Chamberlain. I'm just like, all right. But overall, it's not something I ever revisit in the same way that I revisit Siamese Dream and Gish and Melancholy and Adore too. I mean, Adore for what it is, and it's one of those albums where it's like, that's the moment where everybody was anticipating them to repeat their sound and repeat the songs. And then they came out with that album because I think Billy's mom died. And it's just like, Billy's mom died and Chamberlain overdosed and Jonathan Melvoin, the keyboardist, overdosed and died. And that album became something very sort of like slow and methodical and literally melancholy. And it just was not what people were looking for.
Yeah.
It was just like, you know, Ava Adore came out, and you're like, all right. And then the other songs came out, and you're like, what?
Yeah.
You know.
It's kind of like Weezer hit that with Green and Maladroit. People wanted more Pinkerton.
Right.
It's like, no, we're going to try to go...
Maladroit especially.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Maladroit, I think, was sort of that point for them. You know, the Green album had some really great pop songs on it.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, Maladroit was just sort of like, oops.
I mean, I still enjoy a lot of those tracks. I mean, I thought it was fun. I remember when I was maybe mid-20s or so, when I was still working at a comic book shop downtown, I'd always just bump into James Iha. He was just walking around the neighborhood, and I was like, this will keep the Smashing Pumpkins relevant in my mind, you know?
Yeah,
just
like, mean, and it's like, you know, the music was very of its time, and I love the fact that it was this sort of outpost to grunge that wasn't in Seattle, and it was a different demographic makeup to a band, like we talked about, than a lot of the other bands. The sound was different. The influences were definitely different, and it kind of, I mean, there's stuff that really holds up, and I don't know. It was fun to revisit it, and it was fun to think about this band again for a bit. I listened to them here and there. I don't listen to them any nearly as regularly as I used to.
Yeah, but, same here.
but boy, oh boy, I mean, you just talk about, you know, pulling it off. And I'm a huge Butch Vig fan, and obviously Nevermind and this and Gish, and then, you know, all of his work with Garbage. And
I actually started listening to Garbage again, because for some reason I was like, why do I want to listen to Special right now? And then I was like, all right, I'm just going to listen to Garbage.
It's funny, like, in reading up on Butch Vig while reading up on Siamese Dream, like, they reference the first Garbage album as being like this, you know, they're always asking, what about this album? Like, that's, I didn't realize that was a standard bearer, because I remember Version 2.0 being the one that everybody went apeshit about.
Yeah.
And being like, oh, this is the masterpiece. You know, this is them at the height of their powers. Garbage is a band I really, really like. Even their bad stuff, I think, is somewhat listenable.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the Butch Vig magic. And then, you know, they changed producers, I think, for Melancholy, and he never worked with them again, even though Corgan says they're tight. But this album is definitely him at the height of his powers too. I mean, he said the hardest album he ever made was this album, just because of the drama behind the scenes and Billy redoing everybody's tracks and being a perfectionist, and you know, they worked like 7 days a week for like 6 weeks on trying to get the album done. But I mean, it's all there.
The work pays off.
The work pays off. I mean, it's one of those things where if it was a terrible album, or if it didn't still resonate and it was just, you know, literal garbage, then it would probably be something where he'd be in a straitjacket by now. But like, when you make something this great, I think maybe it does go to show that sometimes the wicked obsession of some artists pays off in the end.
That is true. Now, another question that I just popped into my head is, when you were younger, did you sport any Zero t-shirts? And were your screen names in any way Smashing Pumpkins inspired?
Oh, that's a great question. I definitely had a SIG file on my email in college that was Billy Corgan quotes, for sure. Billy Corgan quotes, and then eventually morphed into Roger Ebert quotes from...
Wow.
Yeah, about bad movies.
That's awesome.
Oh yeah, well he was my biggest influence as a writer, because he showed I felt it was really easy to trash something, but it was very hard to trash it in an intelligent and honest and cutting way. Mm-hmm. And his books about the worst movies that he reviewed were sort of a guidebook to me as a young writer, that you don't just have to be snarky, you can also kind of attack things in a prosecutorial way. And so Ebert became a huge influence to me. So SIG files for sure. And I owned four Smashing Pumpkins t-shirts in my time. I owned the one with the big red heart, which is great. I don't know what happened to that. I probably just left it at somebody's house. I still own a long sleeve Black Zero t-shirt. Well, long sleeve t-shirt. Just because it looks so cool. I mean, it's just, to this day, I think it's just a really cool thing. And it was cool that in Scott Pilgrim, they bought it back.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
Because that became sort of his superior uniform. I own the t-shirt I still own and still wear and very proudly wear is one that has it's from Siamese Dream, and it has an angel on the front of it, and it has sort of this glitter paint. And on the back it says altitude, not attitude, which is just, come on, right? But I love that t-shirt. It's gorgeous. It has Smashing Pumpkins and a big circle around the angel. And I once had somebody offer me $300 for it at a Radio City show.
Wow.
When Pumpkins played there, and I turned them down because I'm like, all right, if they're going to offer me $300 for this t-shirt, it's got to be all right. And then the other one I just actually sold was from the only time I ever saw them in a club, which was in D.C. at 930 Club, and it was right after Chamberlain cleaned up and came back to the band. I bought a I want to say it was called like The Arising or something like that was the name of the tour, and it was like a black t-shirt and had like death on it and souls coming out of the molten pit of hell and
very subtle shirt.
I really don't know, but I mean, what am I gonna do with that? I sold it, and I wound up getting like, I think I like $100 for it or something.
Wow.
Too. I know, right?
Jeez.
There's some other 38-year-old dude out there who's like, how do I get my hands on that damn Pumpkins t-shirt that I didn't buy at that show that one time? Well, now you got it, sir, so congratulations.
I'm still wearing band shirts I bought like 10 years ago. It's just like, all right.
Yeah, I have a few, and a couple of, like, I have one that I love, and it means lots. There's two that mean a lot to me from the Flaming Lips, which is another favorite band of mine before they've kind of gone off the rails in the last few years. And one of them is from something called the Boombox Experiment, which was a gig that they did where they invited 50 people on stage, and Wayne Coyne conducted all of the boomboxes like a symphony. So he would motion to one section to turn down the volume and one section to turn up the volume at different times. And I have a t-shirt from that, which I cherish. And then I had one from a show that I saw at a club that they played in D.C., and I loved it because it had the three of them on there, and it had like all this blood and fireworks and shit. Until somebody pointed out that, you know, in the background of the t-shirt, unbeknownst to my untrained eye, because I suck at magic eye pictures too, were just giant breasts. Like all of the stuff on the t-shirt swirled around to make giant breasts. And like, I have it, but I don't know what to do with it. Like, I can't even wear it to the gym.
Right? Like, someone's going to notice and just like, hey, man.
Hey, nice.
Nice set.
Nice set on you, right? So, yeah. But yeah, you don't want to ever get rid of those. Like, I still think I have like an under bed box somewhere that's just got old t-shirts that are, you know, like from movies and from bands and stuff. I guess me selling the Pumpkin shirt recently could open the floodgates to trying to maybe move some of this shit on eBay and not to keep it in mothballs. But, you know, you never want to get rid of that stuff.
I hear you. Is the 930 Club still open?
It is, I think.
I can't remember. I know I've been to the Rock and Roll Hotel.
Rock and Roll Hotel,
which I love.
Yeah.
That cool place venue. Is awesome.
Yeah, I lived in D.C. for like close to 20 years, so I went to school down there too. And 930 Club was great. Black Cat was a great venue.
Oh, wait, I think I went to that one too.
Saw a lot of really cool bands there. There used to be a club called The Bayou where I saw some fun shows. Capitol Ballroom was a place where I saw the Ramones.
Nice.
It was, DC was a pretty fun spot for bands because they'd all come through and there were a lot of good venues and there wasn't the concentration of population like there is here in New York.
Yeah.
Where you literally, if you don't get a ticket within the first 6.5 seconds of them going on sale, you're not going to the show.
That is the worst lately.
It's the worst. And every venue is like that. Be it Gramercy, be it, you know, wherever you want to go, like you are shot out of tickets.
Yeah.
And the advent of the fan club presale is also a thing too, where it's like, everybody, I mean, which is great for the diehards, but for me, it's not on the mailing list. It kind of blows. But.
Yeah, for most shows I want to go to now, it's me hitting someone up in the industry and be like, hey, it's sold out already.
Right.
Can you help me?
You know who I blame for that? Dave Matthews. Dave Matthews' band of acolytes and hacky-kicking morons getting all the pre-sale tickets to those stadium shows. I think he was the first one to take advantage of the fan club, I think. The fan club presale.
Somewhere there's a Dave Matthews fan listening, cringing.
Yeah, I blame him for that and for so much more.
So I was just laughing about Dave Matthews yesterday with my roommate. We were just doing horrible impersonations. Like realizing we didn't know the words and
space
just
between.
Yeah. Exactly. So what would you say is like the everlasting legacy of this album for you?
it's the band at the height of its powers, and it was Corgan as a songwriter at the height of his powers, where it is hard on your sleeve, adolescent angst, and it kind of was more genuine, I think, than what came after it. And it's also really a really personal album. I mean, we didn't talk about the track Space Boy, about his brother who has like mild cerebral palsy. Like we talked about, you know, suicide stuff and heartbreak and cutting your arms off your parents and like everything else. I mean, I felt like it really was sort of this album that generations of people between the ages of 12 and 16 will pick up, and the themes will mean as much to them as they meant to me in like 93.
Yeah. This is like an album, like as a parent, you could, when your kid's a teenager, you could be like, hey, look, see, I know, I've been there.
Oh, no, it's the album that when you see your teenager with it, you're just, I'll go, shit. Oh, what did I do wrong? Like, why are they mad at me? Or why are they on drugs? Or
yeah, that's one way to look at it, I guess.
I mean, it could be that, but it could also just be like, you're like, all right.
So flip of the coin on
like,
that
honey,
one.
Did you see she picked up Siamese Dream? Oh, no.
I'm going to have like a son and he's going to be going through a breakup and he's going to listen to this and Pinkerton and be like, right. It's okay, man.
Right. Exactly. I guess at the end of the day, it's better than like, you know, Pretty Hate Machine or the Downward Spiral.
Yeah.
Like, there are other albums of that moment that I think would signal, you know, deeper issues than Siamese Dream does.
Yeah. It's like if you ever watched that show, The IT Crowd.
Yeah.
When he's like, you know, I was at a down point in my life and then I found Cradle of Filth. Right. And it saved me it ruined his entire life. It was great.
Right.
So you prepared a bunch of notes. Is there anything we didn't touch on that you would like to cover?
Nah.
I don't want to leave anything out, you
know?
I
think I got it. I would recommend if you're a fan of this album and you've not heard or seen, it's hard to get the video, but the album, I think you can find. They did a video accompaniment called Earphoria, and it has some really cool alternate takes on Disarm, on Mayonnaise, and on Cheer Up Rock especially, which is done acoustically and is really good. And Disarm is completely different because it's a cut from, I think, a British TV show where they do it electric. And actually, I think it's sort of the way they did it on the VMAs when they played it, too. Very nice. Sort of like heavy metal, Black Sabbath-y. Yeah. It's good. So find that if you can, because it was a nice companion piece.
Why is it that those BBC cuts are always so much more fun?
Like the Peel
sessions. Anytime like a band does, and you're like, wait, why isn't that on the
album?
Yeah,
why isn't on the album?
I want to hear that.
Yeah, I don't know if there's anything on there that I would say should supplant these, but it's also great because I think they also had a live version of Silverfuck that goes on for like 20 minutes and involves Billy singing Over the Rainbow, and just it's nuts.
Weird.
But, yeah, it's fun.
Although not surprising when you realize who Billy turned into.
Who he turned into, right. The great pumpkin.
Now, a final thing is I always ask guests to just, we have a Spotify playlist of everyone's like choice pick from the album they choose, whether it's your favorite track or something you think would just be, you know, the most accessible track for someone, you know?
I think the two most accessible songs, well, the three are probably Today, which everybody knows, Cheer Up Rock, which was the first single, which wasn't as big, and I think most people know it, and then Mayonnaise would be the one that I put forth, because it's just a really kind of a summary of a lot of the themes on the album, you know, the breaking away kind of, you know, angsty part of it, and you know, the I'm not good enough part of it sort of thing, and the love in there too. It's a really good track, and it's one that probably should be more well known than it is in the Pumpkin Ovure. But if I had to pick one, I'd say Cheer Up Rock's the time capsule one, because it's just so damn good. And it really kind of, I mean, I love it, the beginning of that song is so great with the drum roll, and then it's sort of, if you picture a roller coaster, when you do the big climb, then you do the drop, it has this like build up to it, and then all of a sudden it's like, and then goes right into the melody, and it's so damn good. It's a really, really great song.
Good comparison.
I remember somebody said at one point that like, if that, what would have happened if that song had hit before Smells Like Teen Spirit? Like, would that have become Smells Like Teen Spirit? And I think that's as blasphemous as it may be to many of your listeners. I think there's something to be said for that song being what it is, and had it hit at a different time, what would it have been?
Interesting. I've never thought of that. Because it's weird, like, where you can put Nirvana and Smashing Pumpkins, the same thing, too. For me, it's always just been, despite as much as they overlap, I've just never, it's like, eh, you're two separate things.
Yeah, they are, and they are, essentially, yeah. Except for the obvious Courtney connection.
Which both bands would be better without.
Yeah, I'll come on next time and do my second favorite Pumpkins album, which is Whole Celebrity Skin.
Well, dude, I want to thank you for being on. I know scheduling was a little tough.
Yeah, no worries.
But hey, we got it done.
Indeed.
I'd also like to thank everyone for listening once again. Be sure to check out, well, if you like hockey, check out Puck Daddy.
Yeah.
There's always some fun articles. And
November, my book, I have a book coming out. Yeah, I know, called Take Your Eye Off the Puck. It's like a guide to watching hockey.
Nice.
And with that sort of Puck Daddy humor.
And you've got a podcast too,
and
don't you?
And the Merrick versus Wyszynski podcast is available every day in the season, but not every day in the off season. But every day in the season, me and Jeff Merrick, who's a guy up in Canada who works for Sportsnet, do a hockey podcast, and look up his name, Marek. Don't look up mine, you'll never spell it.
I've figured it out over the years, so I can do it. So yeah, feel free to check out the playlist on Spotify. Cherub Rock's gonna be on there. And you know, until next time, you know, check us out online, yourfavoritealbum.com, yourfavealbum on Twitter, we're on Facebook, Tumblr, all those good things. So until next time, have a good one, everybody. Goodbye.